Hello, and welcome to my podcast. This is an audio version of my videos, available to make listening to my stuff in the background easier than YouTube makes it. But since my videos are primarily made for YouTube, there may be occasional references to visual materials. If you'd like this podcast ad-free, you can join us on Patreon at patreon.com/vicerhino. Please enjoy. Hello, and welcome to my channel. Vice Rhino here. Today, I'm headed back to the Truth About Vaccines channel in order to battle some more of the misinformation being put out by them. Given the recent announcement of two coronavirus vaccines that look very promising right now, I thought it important to address anyone's potential concerns regarding vaccines. So let's go!
No matter what your position on vaccines might be, you should take a hard look at recent actions by government officials and big corporations to censor and repeal civil liberties that safeguard your human right to autonomy and protection of bodily integrity.
Yes, I don't disagree that keeping an eye on legislation that affects bodily autonomy is important. That being said, we do live in a society, and as members of society, I believe that we have a certain level of obligation to not necessarily go out of our way to protect other members, but at least to make sure that we're not engaging in reckless behavior that will actively harm others. So there are instances where I would say the right to bodily autonomy is superseded by a responsibility to not endanger other members of society. Vaccination is one of those things. The way I see it, vaccines demonstrably save children's lives and prevent great amounts of suffering. For the period of 1994 to 2014, it is estimated that more than 730,000 children's lives have been saved by vaccines, and 322 million cases of childhood illness were prevented. And even putting aside the direct benefit to the children that are not getting sick, vaccines have prevented more than 21 million hospitalizations, saving almost $300 billion in direct costs and $1.38 trillion in societal costs. Vaccinations directly benefit the children and their parents, and indirectly benefit society as a whole. And I believe that society has an obligation to protect its most vulnerable members, which includes children. So, yeah, some parents might get mad that they can't force their children to endure terrible diseases with not insignificant risk of death and permanent disability, but when the benefit is so very obvious and demonstrable, I don't think there is an excuse for allowing children to not be vaccinated, aside from actual medical reasons.
Check out this graphic. You can see the childhood vaccines from birth to 6 months, and then the vaccines from 6 months to 18 months, including DTaP, Hib, Hep B, pneumococcal, polio, Hep A, MMR, chickenpox, flu, and multiple combo vaccines. Not a single one of them had a placebo-controlled trial.
Correct. Do you know why that is? It is because a placebo-controlled trial for a vaccine would be wildly unethical. Typically, a placebo control trial is done with drugs that treat diseases or conditions. You find people in a general population that already have those diseases or conditions, and in addition to the normal standard of care, you provide them with either the new drug that is being developed or a placebo, and you compare the results. If the new drug doesn't do better than the placebo, then the new drug probably doesn't work for that condition. But that's not how most vaccines work. You don't get vaccinated after you get sick. You get vaccinated before you get sick. In order to do a placebo-controlled vaccination trial, you would have to vaccinate some people, inject a placebo in others, and then expose all of them to whatever you were vaccinating them against. That would basically guarantee that the researchers would end up killing people that otherwise would have lived. So vaccine safety has to be studied differently. This is why there are the different phases of vaccine development. And actually, before a vaccine can even get to phase one, it has to go through an exploratory phase followed by preclinical trials. The exploratory phase is basically just, we think this antigen might help grant immunity to a disease, so research is done to see whether or not their research path is even plausible. If it is plausible, they can move on to preclinical trials where they develop a vaccine and test it for safety in animals, and in addition to studying the effectiveness in animal subjects, they also test it against many different and strict standards for quality control and determine what conditions the vaccine can be safely stored in, as well as determining the toxicological and pharmacological effects of the vaccine before using it on humans. Often, several independent studies are published to determine these effects. These studies are designed to mimic the intended clinical use of the vaccine, so if it's a multi-dose vaccine, they will test it against the proposed dosage schedule and modify the schedule if necessary to decrease toxicity and increase effectiveness. If it manages to get through all these hurdles, it will then be submitted to the FDA or equivalent local governing body for approval to begin Phase 1 trials, which will be small-scale trials on human volunteers, typically 20 to 80 in number, with the primary focus being on safety, but they will also continue to use data from this phase to do things like tweak and find the optimal schedule for the vaccine. Phase 2 is pretty much the same as Phase 1, but with a larger sample size, typically 1 to 300 people, and more of a focus on vaccine effectiveness. For any given vaccine, there may be multiple Phase 1 and 2 trials before it finally moves on to Phase 3, and in between each phase, the company making the vaccine has to pass regulatory approval. Phases 1 and 2 provide enough data to ensure that we know the vaccine is not going to have severe negative reactions for most people, but they are too small to suss out what the potential severe negative reactions might be for the small percentage of people who will have them. Phase 3 is a more large-scale phase, often involving tens of thousands of subjects. If there are really severe side effects that the vaccine might have, this is where we'll find them. In order to pass Phase 3, the vaccine has to be shown to have significant effect on the subject's immunity to the disease and have any severe side effects be rare enough that the risk is mitigated by the benefit of the vaccine. And in determining the potential side effects, they report everything. If you fall out of a tree and break your arm while in the vaccine trial, your broken arm goes on the list of conditions that occurred after vaccination. They look at everything, and if anything serious starts happening more frequently than would be expected in the general population, they immediately halt the trial until further study can confirm whether or not that side effect has a causal link to the vaccine. And what's more, going back to how they do Phase 1 studies, they often do make use of placebo controls. But rather than exposing the people to the virus that they're attempting to prevent, they instead measure the antibodies produced by the test subjects. Also of note is that even if the vaccine is being developed for use in children and infants, it is tested in adults. And then for every vaccine after Phase 3 is passed, epidemiological data is continuously collected and analyzed in the general population in order to make sure that nothing was missed during the trials. So, yes, sometimes a vaccine will come to market without first having a placebo-controlled study performed. But a placebo-controlled study is not the only way to test safety, and in the case of many vaccines, is often the inappropriate type of safety test because, you know, ethics.
Let's listen to Del Bigtree as he dives deeper into this cognitive dissonance regarding vaccines, especially with politicians, and links it to the Big Pharma lobby and highlights the lack of randomized, double-blind, placebo-controlled studies.
The pharma lobby is the most powerful in Washington. It's true, it's the number one most powerful lobby. What's it doing there?
Well, I'm glad you asked. The pharma lobby is the number one political lobby in the United States. Why is it number one? Well, for some reason, drug manufacturing companies seem to want Republicans in office, giving three times as much financial support to Republican candidates over Democrats. They lobby against legislation that would make drugs more affordable to the people that need them.
I personally thank God we pay too much for drugs. I mean, the right amount. I mean, not enough. Here, watch this video.
And they lobby quite effectively as well, as can be seen by the stark contrast in drug pricing between countries. In Canada, for instance, you can get a vial of insulin for $30. That same vial, under a different brand name, goes for over $300 in the United States. The scientists who first developed insulin as a treatment for diabetes sold the patent to the University of Toronto for $1 because they thought it would be unethical to profit off of a life-saving medication. Higher costs are often justified by these lobby groups as being necessary to fund research and development. But according to former Pfizer CEO Hank McKinnell, it is the anticipated income stream rather than the repayment of sunk costs that is the primary determinant of price. But that's off topic. I'm sure some lobbying does go on with regards to vaccines as well. But also keep in mind that alternative medicine lobby groups would also fall into the pharmaceuticals slash health products category. So it is entirely possible, likely even, that the people who made this documentary also have directly contributed to the number one political lobby in the United States, which is now being demonized by them for what doesn't even appear to be the primary goal of the lobby.
Yet Bernie Sanders or, you know, Elizabeth Warren will say, I'm anti-pharma lobby, I am pro-vaccine mandate and removing exemptions.
Yes, Bernie advocated for the minimizing of non-medical exemptions, and I don't know about Warren, but Bernie returned any funds that were donated to him by drug companies and implored other Democrats to do the same. And remember, these lobbyists typically give 3 times as much to Republican candidates as they do to Democratic ones, so if you're trying to pretend that Medicare for All is something that the pharmaceutical companies are promoting, then you're ignoring a big chunk of the picture.
I don't understand why they don't see that the fastest growing sector of pharma is vaccines.
If that's true, that's amazing. Because, I mean, you know that whole an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure?
The future of that industry is vaccines for many reasons.
Because they work, mostly. People don't like being sick and potentially dying, especially not if there's a way to prevent it. Vaccines prevent it.
One, you cannot sue them if they injure you because of the 1986 Vaccine Injury Compensation Act that took all liability away from the industry and anyone that gives you a vaccine.
It did not remove all liability. It removed liability as long as the company and those involved followed all of the required protocols. If a vaccine company makes it through trials based on something fraudulent, then they are liable for that fraud. What it did was protect companies from being sued into oblivion for side effects that aren't actually related to the vaccine. It started with the DTP vaccine, diphtheria, tetanus, and pertussis. This vaccine originally had some side effects that, well, relatively minimal, were more shocking than the side effects that we are used to. It could cause fevers, and in some cases where a genetic predisposition existed, it could cause fever seizures. This led to a similar scenario that exists now with the MMR vaccine and autism. Parents whose children were diagnosed with various forms of encephalopathy around the time of their children's vaccinations started thinking there was a causal link between the two, despite robust studies both at the time and in retrospect confirming no causal link. During this time period in the US, there went from being 26 vaccine manufacturers in 1967 to just 3 in 1986, with many of them being sued out of business for effects that demonstrably had no causal link to the vaccines. So in 1986, the act that he's referring to was passed, and the National Vaccine Injury Compensation Program, or the so-called Vaccine Court, was established. The Vaccine Court exists because we recognize that legitimate damage from vaccines does exist, and the people who suffer these damages deserve compensation. But the Vaccine Court doesn't require the establishment of a causal link. All you have to do is show that some effect was observed temporally close to when the vaccine was administered, and you get a payout. And if you don't like the payout, you are free to reject it and then take the actual vaccine company to court. But in order to be successful in court, you then need to show an actual causal link and demonstrate that the company was not properly following the regulatory guidelines. So it is difficult to directly sue a vaccine company, yes, but not impossible. And these measures were put into place for the direct benefit of public health. If everyone sues vaccine companies into oblivion, then nobody will want to make vaccines, and we get to go back to dealing with deadly diseases like the measles.
So now you have the pharmaceutical industry, who loses billion-dollar lawsuits almost every week now. It feels like we're seeing these lies being upturned in courtrooms around America and the world.
Okay, so they're being sued so often that we're hearing about it weekly. That's why the visuals you provided were cases that are years old, right? Like, one is from 2009, one is from 2013, and then the most recent one, the 2019 case, actually didn't have much to do with their product. It was more about business shenanigans to avoid paying bonuses to shareholders. But yeah, we're hearing about it weekly. To prove it, here's a news article from more than a decade ago. And the 2 lawsuits that were actually about their drugs? They were for fraudulent marketing. There is a massive problem in the United States with the way drug companies market their products.
Of course, this wouldn't be necessary if retail drug prices were reasonable. Dr. Julius Hibbert, do you agree?
Well, I can't give the drug companies a break. They have lots of hidden costs, and they know how to treat a brother.
I am not going to sit here and defend the drug companies' marketing practices, but despite their shady marketing tactics, there are drugs that they make that we actually need. Now, certainly, I would be in favor of regulation on how much they can charge for their drugs, and tighter regulations on how they market them, not to mention salary caps for their executives.
In fact, you personally received half a million dollars... personally, just by tripling the price of Revlimid. So to recap here, the drug didn't get any better, the cancer patients didn't get any better, you just got better at making money.
These lawsuits are the results of existing regulatory system doing its job, and the whistleblowers are getting generous compensation for blowing the whistle, a lot of times more than they get from working for the company. In the case of Pfizer's $2.3 billion settlement, the whistleblowers got about $17 million each. Is the regulatory system perfect? Not by a long shot. And remember, it's marketing you're worried about with these lawsuits. They don't spend a lot of money marketing their vaccines. Vaccines make up less than 3% of the pharmaceutical industry's profits. Vaccines are a $24 billion market, which seems like a lot to those of us who will never see a bank account with even a $1 million balance. But to put that in perspective, the alternative medicine category is a $34 billion industry. And you're here complaining about the lack of a very specific safety test for vaccines, ignoring all of the safety data that is collected through different methods. Meanwhile, only an estimated one-third of alternative medicine treatments have gone through any sort of safety testing.
They make a product we can't get into a courtroom.
No, you can get them into a courtroom. You just need to have actual evidence of any wrongdoing on the part of the vaccine company first. They don't make huge profits off of the vaccines. If everybody could sue them for anything, causal link or no, then they wouldn't bother making vaccines. If, however, they don't follow these strict safety protocols for their vaccines, then yes, you can take them to court. You just have to go through the vaccine court first.
A product that's given to our children, and the only product of all those being sued that have never been through a safety study.
Nope, that is a flat-out lie. They have not been through one very specific type of safety study that would be unethical to perform with a product like vaccines, but they have been through numerous other safety studies.
Here's one more clip of the World Health Organization Vaccine Safety Summit from December 3rd, 2019. Listen to Dr. David Kaslow discussing maternal vaccinations, which he calls, quote, the new target population for vaccines.
Sounds reasonable to me, especially considering the fact that several studies involving a total of over 100,000 pregnant women have come to the conclusion that getting your flu shot while pregnant results in fewer preterm deliveries, better birth weights, and cut stillbirths by half. Almost like making sure that a person who is pregnant can stay healthy will have a positive health impact on the baby that they're carrying.
Coming down the pike, maybe relatively quickly, is a new target population for us in vaccines, and that's maternal immunization. And these are women who are pregnant who will have all kinds of adverse events associated with their pregnancy. Part of the problem is that we don't have a strong enough pharmacoepidemiologic baseline in the target populations that we're studying to be able to say, is this an expected adverse event due to pregnancy, or is this related to the vaccine? So I do think an investment in that kind of epidemiologic baseline is going to be critically important if we don't want to derail some of our maternal immunization vaccines as they go into low resource settings.
Translation: we need to study pregnant people more so that we have more data and can produce more products for them that we know are safe. Would you rather see these studies not be done? Were you not just complaining about the lack of safety studies? He's literally sitting there talking about how more safety studies need to be conducted so that we can give more effective immunization to people that are in a particularly vulnerable stage of their lives, and that's supposed to be bad?
I do think an investment in adequate safety studies would be helpful for us so that we don't derail this money train.
Am I going crazy? Were you not just advocating earlier in this video for more safety studies to be done? Were you not complaining about the lack of safety studies? So why are you now criticizing this guy for saying that we need more safety studies? I mean, sure, you're claiming that they're doing it all for the profits, which is ironic given that you sell books promoting alternative cancer treatments, placing you squarely in the alternative medicine category that makes about $10 billion more annually than vaccine sales do. But even if I grant that they're in it for the profit, what do you think is going to be more profitable? Selling a product that doesn't work and actively causes harm to the people that buy it? Or selling a product that does work and is safe? Oh shit, that's a cell phone for me, isn't it? After all, I did just point out that the industry that sells products that actively cause harm and don't work makes $10 billion more annually than safe and effective vaccinations do. My bad. Maybe we should consider applying the same safety and efficacy standards to alternative medicines too. I wonder why alt-med companies lobby against being regulated in the same way as actual medicine.
But this is not a laughing matter.
You're right. It's not. People have died as a direct result of listening to anti-vax propaganda. There were at least 9,028 deaths due to vaccine-preventable diseases in between 2007 and 2015. Now, sure, people have died as a direct result of being vaccinated too, but we have to keep the risk in perspective. For starters, when studying death rates, the death rate for the 2 months following vaccination is lower than the overall death rate for the general population, and an average vaccine has about a 1 in a million chance of causing an anaphylactic reaction, which is roughly the same risk as eating a day's worth of food. So getting a vaccine is about as risky as eating 3 meals in a day. But because vaccines are given in medical environments with trained medical staff on hand, the deaths from these reactions are much lower than the deaths from eating. A 10-year review of claims to the vaccine court found a total of 5 cases of death from anaphylaxis linked to the vaccine, while every year, 150 to 200 people die from anaphylaxis related to food. And yes, there have been instances of death from things other than anaphylaxis that are linked to vaccines, but the side effects and risk of these side effects occurring are significantly less than the risks of the diseases that the vaccines prevent. Literally nothing in life is 100% risk-free. You have a greater chance of getting hit by lightning on your way to buy a lottery ticket than you do of winning the lottery. In fact, you have a greater chance of getting hit by lightning than of ever experiencing a severe adverse reaction to a vaccine, and yet we don't cower inside for fear of lightning strikes. And what's more, with a vaccine, you get significant protection against one or more diseases that have a much greater chance of doing you severe harm than lightning strikes. So it's really a no-brainer.
Dr. Kaslow just insinuated that safety studies have not been done with maternal vaccines.
That's actually a real possibility. I mean, sure, there have been the epidemiological studies that I referenced earlier, but a persistent problem in medicine is that historically, the male body has been the most studied body. It has always just been assumed that the female body works in the exact same way, but also with a uterus. But then the scientific method started developing, and it was found that the female body really is quite different in more than just superficial ways. And so female lab animals and human subjects started being actively excluded from research because the menstrual cycle and the varying hormone levels were seen as potential confounding factors that would introduce unwanted complications. Meanwhile, the predominantly male doctors were prescribing treatments for women based on research performed on male bodies, and would then diagnose the women with hysteria if the treatment didn't work. And while this is not quite the problem that it used to be, it still is a problem. So this doctor is advocating performing more safety studies involving pregnancy and vaccines. Good. That's it for this one. Today's comment of the day comes to us from Galby3000, who says, "You can and should point out that the Bible is self-contradicting and full of violations of moral codes, but when you start saying, 'We don't have a book that,' it seems like you are taking the high ground as though there are no other books of fiction in existence. We don't have a book that violates every potential principle that could be posited as a moral absolute. You do. Who's to say that every novel ever written violates moral absolutes? Sure, you could argue that there are none that violate every moral absolute, but are you sure the Bible violates every one of them? Correct me if I am wrong here, I have not read the book myself, it seems to be a very tedious read to me. And more importantly, have you read every book ever written? As for it being self-contradicting, even books of law can be. Plus, I have spotted many self-contradicting elements of stories in quite a few books that I have read, and they just have one author." Well, you see, the thing with this is, when I say we don't have a book that violates these principles, you do. I'm not saying that no book exists outside of the Bible that violates those principles or has contradictions or whatever. I am saying that we, with the we here referring to atheists, don't have a book that we believe is the perfect source of morality. Maybe there are some atheists out there somewhere who do have such a book, I don't know, but I have never met an atheist that would place any book on the kind of reverent pedestal that is given to the Bible by Christians. Thanks for watching. Special thanks as always to my patrons, Lynn Dobbs, Mark McManus, What Jesus, and all the rest, who are the studies that demonstrate that the alternative medicine that is my channel is safe and effective, meaning there aren't nearly enough of them. If you'd like to find out how dangerous I really am, you can join us on Patreon for as little as $1 per week over at patreon.com/vicerhino. If you feel so inclined, you can also support the channel through direct donation or my Amazon wishlist, which are linked in the description, as well as my social media accounts and my P.O. Box address and my podcast, because if you want this as a podcast, it's there for you. See you next time!